Serve Jehovah with rejoicing, says Psalm 100, verse 2. Yes, Jehovah wants us to be joyful, and He's given us many reasons to rejoice. He gave us life with His many joys. He gave us the Bible to teach us how to enjoy life, and He guides us into countless joyful experiences. Yes, Jehovah is the God who gives joy. Satan, however, does not want us to find joy in serving Jehovah. Why not? For one thing, he knows that joy helps us to keep on preaching and teaching the very work he wants to stop. So he tries to destroy our joy, sometimes through official opposition, and at other times through family and community pressure. Satan also wants us to cut back our service to Jehovah in order to obtain unnecessary material things. He wants us to think that getting more and more material things will bring us lasting joy. It won't. Satan's tactics are not new, as we now read portions of the books of Ezra, Haggai, and Zechariah. Look for lessons that can help us to serve Jehovah with rejoicing today. Note what brought Jehovah's people joy back then and what robbed them of their joy. And consider why and how we can experience the joy of Jehovah today, even under trying circumstances. Ezra, a priest and a copyist of the Law of Moses, is the writer of the book that bears his name. The book of Ezra picks up the history of Israel from the end of 2 Chronicles, which likely Ezra also wrote. It's 537 BCE, and many Jews are about to return to Judah. The nation has spent 70 years in captivity to Babylon for practicing idol worship. They've learned a hard lesson, and never again does the entire nation fall back into idolatry. Now, the time has come to get pure worship back on its feet in Jerusalem. The account spans the reigns of several Persian kings, starting with King Cyrus, and it has a joyful beginning. Please open to Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 6, and follow along.
In the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, in order that Jehovah's words spoken by Jeremiah would be fulfilled, Jehovah stirred the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia to make a proclamation throughout his kingdom, which he also put in writing, saying,
"This is what King Cyrus of Persia says. Jehovah, the God of the heavens, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has commissioned me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. And let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of Jehovah, the God of Israel. He is the true God, whose house was in Jerusalem. Anyone who is residing as a foreigner, wherever he may be, let him be helped by his neighbors, by their giving him silver and gold, goods and livestock, along with the voluntary offering for the house of the true God, which was in Jerusalem."
Then the heads of the paternal houses of Judah and of Benjamin and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose spirit the true God had stirred, prepared to go up and rebuild the house of Jehovah, which was in Jerusalem. All those around them supported them by giving them utensils of silver and of gold, goods, livestock, and valuable things, besides all the voluntary offerings.
Just imagine. Jehovah returns the Jews to their land with a commission from King Cyrus himself to rebuild the temple. Many Jews joyfully take up this assignment. However, those who for various reasons cannot give financial support to those who can. Likely in the early spring of 537 BCE, nearly 50,000 Israelites depart Babylon. Leading them are High Priest Jeshua, also called Joshua, and the governor whom Cyrus appointed, Zerubbabel. In the early autumn, they arrive in Judah, and they are joyful. But how can they sustain that joy? Note what they do as soon as they get settled. Let's read Ezra chapter 3, verses 1 through 6.
When the seventh month arrived, and the Israelites were in their cities, they gathered together with one accord in Jerusalem. Jeshua, the son of Jehozadak, and his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brothers, rose up and built the altar of the God of Israel, so that they could offer up burnt sacrifices on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of the true God. So they set the altar up on its former site, despite their fear of the peoples of the surrounding lands. And they began offering up burnt sacrifices to Jehovah on it, the morning and the evening burnt sacrifices. Then they held the festival of booths, according to what is written. And day by day they offered up the specified number of burnt sacrifices that were required each day. Afterward, they offered up the regular burnt offering, and the offerings for the new moons, and those for all the sanctified festival seasons of Jehovah, as well as those from everyone who willingly offered a voluntary offering to Jehovah. From the first day of the seventh month, they started to offer up burnt sacrifices to Jehovah, though the foundation of Jehovah's temple had not yet been laid.
Did you notice that the Jews reinstitute Jehovah's worship despite their fear of the peoples of the surrounding lands? Because of their courageous action, this is a very joyful time. It's just as Moses said when he instructed the nation to celebrate the festival of booths, "You will become nothing but joyful." The next year, they courageously and joyfully lay the foundation for the temple. Let's read about that at Ezra chapter 3, verses 10 through 13.
When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of Jehovah, then the priests in official clothing, with the trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with the cymbals, stood up to praise Jehovah, according to the direction of King David of Israel. And they began to sing in response by praising and giving thanks to Jehovah, for he is good. His loyal love toward Israel endures forever. Then all the people shouted with a loud shout of praise to Jehovah, because the foundation of the house of Jehovah had been laid. Many of the priests, the Levites, and the heads of the paternal houses, the old men who had seen the former house, wept with a loud voice when they saw the foundation of this house being laid, while many others shouted joyfully at the top of their voice. So the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shouts from the sound of the weeping, for the people were shouting so loudly that the sound was heard from a great distance.
Yes, some of the oldest members of the nation cannot imagine how this temple could possibly match the glory of Solomon's temple. But the others, joyful shouting overpowers their weeping. The people of the surrounding lands, however, do not rejoice. Instead, they cunningly target Israel's joy. Let's see how in Ezra chapter 4, verses 1 through 3.
When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to Jehovah, the God of Israel, they immediately approached Zerubbabel and the heads of the paternal houses and said to them,
"Let us build along with you, for like you, we worship your God, and we have been sacrificing to him since the days of King Esarhaddon of Assyria, who brought us here."
However, Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the heads of the paternal houses of Israel said to them,
"You have no share with us in building a house to our God, for we alone will build it to Jehovah, the God of Israel, just as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us."
Zerubbabel discerns that behind their enemies' offer to help lurk bad motives. When he rejects their offer, they try to prevent the Jews from working on the temple. Notice how verses 4 to 7 continue.
Then the people of the land were continually discouraging the people of Judah and disheartening them from building. They hired advisors against them to frustrate their plans all the days of King Cyrus of Persia until the reign of King Darius of Persia. At the beginning of the reign of Ahasuerus, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. And in the days of King Artaxerxes of Persia, Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabiel, and the rest of his colleagues wrote to Artaxerxes the king. They translated the letter into Aramaic, writing it with Aramaic characters.
Let's read what Rehum, the chief government official, and others of Israel's enemies write to the king. Consider what kind of false accusations they make, as recorded in Ezra chapter 4, verses 11 through 16.
This is a copy of the letter that they sent him.
To King Artaxerxes from your servants, the men of the region beyond the river. And now, let it be known to the king that the Jews who came up here from you to us have arrived at Jerusalem. They are rebuilding the rebellious and wicked city, and they are finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. Now let it be known to the king that if this city should be rebuilt and its walls finished, they will not give tax, tribute, or toll, and it will result in a loss to the treasuries of the kings. Since we eat the salt of the palace, and it is not proper for us to see the king's interests harmed, we have therefore sent to make this known to the king, so that there may be an investigation of the book of records of your ancestors. You will find in the book of records and learn that this city is a rebellious city, injurious to kings and provinces, and within it have been those stirring up sedition from ancient times. That is why this city was destroyed. We are making known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls are finished, you will have no control of the region beyond the river.
Do those false accusations sound familiar? They're the same ones our enemies sometimes hurl against us today. They don't pay taxes. They work against the government's interests. They're rebellious and seditious. They're uncontrollable. All false charges, of course. And back then, they had their effect. The king orders the work halted, and temple rebuilding comes to a standstill. How sad. When the Jews first returned, they didn't let fear of man stop them from doing Jehovah's work. But now they do. Many of us today face increasing opposition to Jehovah's work. But compromising or giving up has never brought anyone joy, just the opposite. Remaining faithful brings joy, even in the face of violent persecution. But how is that possible? Consider a true life example. Picture a mother and daughter surrounded by a mob of angry men demanding that they buy political party cards. What would the sisters do? If they compromised and bought the cards, their persecutors would rejoice. But afterward, the sisters would be miserable, knowing they had denied their Heavenly Father. The sisters did not give in. Of course, they didn't enjoy being ridiculed and mistreated. Later, however, their consciences were clean, and they felt deep joy knowing they had remained faithful to Jehovah. What about the Jews of Ezra's day? Many may have left a stable life in Babylon to make the arduous trek to Judah. Now, after about 14 years of constant opposition from the laying of the temple's foundation up to the ban, the Jews have lost their zeal for Jehovah's work. They go through the motions of offering sacrifices, but they're not doing what Jehovah told them to do, finish rebuilding the temple. When they meet resistance, they rationalize that it must not be Jehovah's time to finish the work. Apparently, even Governor Zerubbabel and High Priest Jeshua need encouragement. To provide it, Jehovah sends the prophet Haggai. Let's turn now to the book of Haggai, chapter 1. Haggai's clear and powerful messages delivered during a period of about 4 months get right to the heart of the matter, as we read Haggai chapter 1, verses 2 through 11.
This is what Jehovah of armies says. These people say, "The time has not yet come for the house of Jehovah to be built." And the word of Jehovah again came through Haggai the prophet, saying, "Is it the time for you to dwell in your paneled houses, while this house lies in ruins? Now this is what Jehovah of armies says. Set your heart on your ways. You have sown much seed, but you harvest little. You eat, but it is not to satisfaction. You drink, but you do not drink your fill. You put on clothing, but no one gets warm. The one who hires himself out puts his wages in a bag full of holes. This is what Jehovah of armies says. Set your heart on your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring in lumber and build the house so that I may take pleasure in it and I may be glorified, Jehovah says. You were expecting much and receiving little. And when you brought it into the house, I blew it away. For what reason, declares Jehovah of armies? Because my house is in ruins, while each of you runs around taking care of his own house. So the heavens above you withheld their dew, and the earth withheld its produce. And I kept calling for a drought on the earth, on the mountains, on the grain, on the new wine, on the oil, on what grows from the ground, on humans and livestock, and on all the labor of your hands."
Jehovah compares the results of the Jews' self-centered efforts to those of a hired worker who puts his wages into a moth-eaten sack. Because the Jews are neglecting the house of Jehovah, he holds back his blessing. The results of the Jews' labor are limited, and their lives lack joy. Evidently, some try to fill that void by beautifying their own homes. But material things cannot satisfy spiritual needs. Can we see the warning here for us? It's not wrong to enjoy nice things, but material things cannot bring us true and lasting joy, especially if we neglect Jehovah's work to obtain them. Remember the lesson of Psalm 127, verse 1. Unless Jehovah builds the house, it is in vain that its builders work hard on it. On the other hand, when we unselfishly seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness, he provides what we really need and at just the right time. As Proverbs chapter 10, verse 22 tells us, "It is the blessing of Jehovah that makes one rich, and he adds no pain with it." But now, will this rebuilt temple really not attain to its former glory, as some believe? Through Haggai, Jehovah guarantees that the future glory of this house will be even greater. Let's continue reading at Haggai chapter 2, verses 3 through 9.
"Who is left among you who saw this house in its former glory? How does it look to you now? Does it not seem like nothing in comparison? But now be strong, Zerubbabel, declares Jehovah, and be strong, Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. And be strong, all you people of the land, declares Jehovah, and work, for I am with you, declares Jehovah of armies. Remember what I promised you when you came out of Egypt, and my spirit remains among you. Do not be afraid. For this is what Jehovah of armies says. Yet once more, in a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth, and the sea and the dry land. And I will shake all the nations, and the precious things of all the nations will come in. And I will fill this house with glory, says Jehovah of armies. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, declares Jehovah of armies. The future glory of this house will be greater than the former,
says Jehovah of armies.
Yes, when the creator and owner of the entire universe declares his purpose, who or what could possibly prevent him from carrying it out? Nothing and no one. Jehovah's straightforward message is unmistakable. Still, the returnees need more encouragement. Jehovah sends his angel to another prophet, Zechariah. Please turn to Zechariah chapter 1, verses 12 through 16, and let's read together the angel's reassuring words for Israel. That's Zechariah 1, 12 through 16.
So the angel of Jehovah said,
O Jehovah of armies, how long will you withhold your mercy from Jerusalem and the cities of Judah, with whom you have been indignant these 70 years?
Jehovah answered the angel who was speaking with me with kind and comforting words. Then the angel who was speaking with me told me,
Call out, this is what Jehovah of armies says. I am zealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great zeal. With great indignation, I am indignant with the nations that are at ease, because I felt indignant to a small extent, but they added to the calamity. Therefore, this is what Jehovah says. I will return to Jerusalem with mercy, and my own house will be built in her, declares Jehovah of armies. And a measuring line will be stretched out over Jerusalem.
To emphasize just how protective Jehovah will be, the angel continues at chapter 2, verses 7 through 9.
Come, Zion, make your escape, you who are dwelling with the daughter of Babylon. For this is what Jehovah of armies says, who after being glorified has sent me to the nations that were plundering you. Whoever touches you touches the pupil of my eye. For now I will wave my hand against them, and they will become plunder for their own slaves. And you will certainly know that Jehovah of armies has sent me.
Would you let someone poke his finger in your eye? Of course not. Neither will Jehovah allow Israel's opposers to harm them. Then in Zechariah chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, the angel reveals the greater enemy behind the opposition.
And he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of Jehovah, and Satan was standing at his right hand to resist him. Then the angel of Jehovah said to Satan,
May Jehovah rebuke you, O Satan. Yes, may Jehovah, who has chosen Jerusalem, rebuke you. Is not this one a burning log snatched out of the fire?
Is all this intended simply to build up Israel's confidence in themselves? On the contrary, they need to remember that only with Jehovah's help can they accomplish anything. Listen to the angel's further words to Zechariah in chapter 4, verses 6 through 7.
This is the word of Jehovah to Zerubbabel. Not by a military force, nor by power, but by my spirit, says Jehovah of armies. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you will become a level land. And he will bring out the top stone amid shouts of, How wonderful! How wonderful!
Energized by Jehovah's motivating words through his two prophets, the Jews stopped wavering in a lack of faith and resumed construction of the temple. Predictably, Israel's enemy neighbors, led by Tattenai and Shetharboznai, also spring into action. Returning to the book of Ezra, we read at chapter 5, verses 3 through 5.
At that time, Tattenai, the governor of the region beyond the river, and Shetharboznai and their colleagues came to them and asked them,
Who issued an order to you to build this house and to finish this structure?
Then they asked them,
What are the names of the men who are working on this building?
But God was watching over the elders of the Jews, and they did not stop them until the report could be sent to Darius, and an official document could be sent back concerning this.
So there's another lesson for us today when we courageously do Jehovah's work despite opposition. Jehovah blesses our efforts and enables us to keep on serving Him. For now, though, the Jews must continue their work on the temple under ban. The king who issued the ban, however, was assassinated after reigning only 7 months. So Tatnai and his accomplices are dealing with a new king, Darius I. In denouncing the Jews, they try to use Zerubbabel's own words against him, including his statement that King Cyrus issued the order to rebuild the temple. They ask King Darius to investigate whether that's really so. Darius orders the investigation. What will King Darius decide? Will the Jews' renewed faith and determination bring them joy, or just more trouble? Darius learns that Cyrus did indeed order that the temple be rebuilt. At Ezra chapter 6, verses 6 through 12, we read Darius' stinging reply.
So now, Tatnai, the governor of the region beyond the river, Shetharbozenai, and your colleagues, the lesser governors of the region beyond the river, stay away from there. Do not interfere with the work on that house of God. The governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews will rebuild that house of God in its former place. Furthermore, I am issuing an order as to what you are to do for these elders of the Jews for rebuilding that house of God. From the royal treasury, from the tax collected in the region beyond the river, the expenses are to be promptly given to these men to continue without interruption. And whatever is needed, young bulls as well as rams and lambs for the burnt offerings to the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, and oil, just as the priests who are in Jerusalem say, is to be given them continually, day by day, without fail, so that they may continually present offerings that please the God of the heavens, and pray for the life of the king and his sons. I have also issued an order that if anyone violates this decree, a timber will be pulled out of his house, and he will be lifted up and fastened to it, and his house will be turned into a public latrine for this offense. And may the God who has caused his name to reside there overthrow any king and people who lift a hand to violate this order and destroy that house of God, which is in Jerusalem. I, Darius, issue this order. Let it be done promptly.
Upon receiving the king's command, Tatnai and his colleagues have no choice. Not only must they stop interfering with the work on the temple, they must help finance it. What a joyful outcome for the faithful Jews. In 515 BCE, they hold the inauguration of the house of God with joy. And as we read it, verse 22.
They also joyfully held the festival of unleavened bread for 7 days, for Jehovah caused them to rejoice. And he had made the heart of the king of Assyria favorable toward them, so that he supported them in the work of the house of the true God, the God of Israel.
Today, when wise and just officials similarly intervene in our behalf, we're very grateful to them. But we're most grateful to Jehovah for directing matters. As Proverbs 21, verse 1 says, "A king's heart is like streams of water in Jehovah's hand. He directs it wherever he pleases." So we do not put our ultimate hope in any ruler or institution of this world. None of them can bring us permanent salvation. In fact, before the end of Satan's system, all the nations will turn against Jehovah's people, but they'll experience an outcome worse than that of Tatnai's. What lessons can we draw from these portions of Ezra, Haggai, and Zechariah? First, Jehovah blesses our determined efforts to keep on doing His work despite challenges, but He frustrates the efforts of our opposers. Second, when we put Jehovah's work ahead of material comforts, He gives us true joy. What's the work Jesus commissioned us to do today? He made it very clear in His parting words to His followers. Go, therefore, and make disciples of people of all the nations. Are we, with our hearts and hands, putting this assignment ahead of material goals? Haggai foretold that one day Jehovah's temple would become far more glorious than the one Solomon built. That prophecy is being fulfilled today. Jehovah is using our preaching to shake the nations. Millions of precious things, new worshipers, are coming to him. These are joyfully flocking to the great spiritual temple, Jehovah's arrangement for worshiping him on the basis of Jesus' ransom sacrifice. Now is not the time to focus our attention on paneled houses or on any other unnecessary pursuit. Very soon, on a day we do not expect, Satan's world will end, and we will enter Jehovah's new world. So no matter how Satan tries to discourage or distract us now, may we never let him rob us of our joy in Jehovah. May we rather walk with Jehovah right into his peaceful new world, where we will serve him forever with rejoicing. Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Haggai, and Zechariah have done much to help Israel regain Jehovah's favor. Later in 468 BCE, Ezra himself comes to Jerusalem to support true worship. But the nation needs still more direction. So Jehovah sends them another brave leader. During the next 2 days of this convention, we'll learn about that faithful and powerful man, Nehemiah.